morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you very much for being here this morning, bright and early. We have two bills that we're going to be taking public testimony on, and we're going to probably be separating out some of the testimony on the first bill that we're going to hear is going to be Senate Bill 1556. Because of the number of people we have on the second bill, 1550, plus the number of those individuals who are from great distances from the Capitol, we will be bifurcating or splitting the testimony on 1556 based on those who I believe are further away as compared to those who are more closer to the Capitol that will be able to come back. So with that, let's go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1556. And also, before we get going on that, we do have a work session that we are going to be doing, but I want to let the other members that to get here before we take votes on those. So with that, on Senate Bill 1556, I believe, Whitney, this is yours.
Yes, thank you, Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee. This is Senate Bill 1556. It is brought to us by Senator Manez Anderson. We do not have the fiscal or revenue impact statements yet. This bill pertains to ORS 161.015, which defines physical injury to be either substantial pain or impairment of physical condition. The Court of Appeals has defined impairment of physical condition to mean harm to the body that results in a reduction in one's ability to use the body or bodily organ for less than a protracted period of time. Substantial pain has been defined by the Court of Appeals to refer to the degree and duration of the pain suffered by the victim. Last week, the Court of Appeals further held that a jury can infer substantial pain from the evidence at trial despite a lack of a direct evidence to the pain level or substantial pain element. We also have a Dash 1 amendment, which is also brought to us by Senator Manez Anderson. It defines vulnerable victim as only a dependent person. It also amends relating statutes with physical injury as an element to include intentionally or knowingly cause injury to a vulnerable victim. There is no reckless mental state for the vulnerable victim physical injury crimes. There all does appear this amendment just came out last night, and there may be some revisions needed to it.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Members of the committee, I'm State Senator Lori Manez Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdelwood Village, and Fairview. And thank you again for hearing Senate Bill 1556. There are many people who would like to see the definition of physical injury in our statute changed, we would like to add fractures, cuts, punctures, bruises, and burns to the definition. We've narrowed this bill from last session, and the Dash 1 amendments will narrow it even further, removing a reckless mental state for those crimes and also removing the 65 and older provision. We were hoping that would calm the membership on the elders who are automatically vulnerable and make clear that we are only talking about intentional crimes. I think that we have the support of the police chiefs and sheriffs, and I've been talking with CARES Northwest. Hopefully they'll be able to testify too on this bill. I think it's extremely important that we protect the most vulnerable persons in our community, and since we've narrowed it even further from the original that you've heard previously, I'm hoping that you will consider moving it after we get the amendment problem solved. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Senator Lori Manez Anderson? Thank you very much. So what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and take a panel at this point that will include the following. That will be Kevin Barton, Dinah Vittle, Jeff Rhodes. And as they're coming forward, we're going to watch and monitor the time. I need to leave close to a little over an hour is what we committed to for the other bill, but we all want some flexibility there. So we'll see if we can get a second panel on 1556 in after this one, or if we're going to have to wait.
Thank you.
So one thing I'd like for y'all to also, I think you've already been put on notice as to one of the concerns with the new case that's come out, State versus Guzman. I'd like to make certain that you're covering as to why you believe 1556 is necessary with that decision that's come out this last week.
Thank you. Chair Przyzowski, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee, my name is Diana Vidalins, and I am the president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. First, I want to thank Senator Manas Anderson and Representative Olson for bringing this very important concept forward this session. I also want to thank you, Chair Przyzowski, for inviting us to testify on this matter during the interim. We are here today to ask for your support in protecting the most vulnerable Oregonians. Senate Bill 1556 with the Dash 1 amendments are the result of multiple sessions of work, and we are very proud of the final product. Senate Bill 1556 updates the definition of physical injury in cases where dependent persons and children are victims of abuse. These are special cases with special considerations. In a case where the abuser is the caretaker for the victim, you can only imagine the difficulty the victims face in coming forward. Because these victims are either nonverbal or easily coerced by parents and caretakers, prosecutors have difficulty making certain that abusers are held accountable. This needs to change now, and these victims cannot wait. What we are asking is that for this very small class of victims, the court allow objective testimony concerning the victim's injuries. This means that rather than putting a child through the trauma of discussing how much their injuries hurt, we can allow a doctor, a first responder, or an expert to testify why the injuries caused impairment of physical condition or substantial pain. This is not tantamount to a free pass for the prosecution in these cases. We are not changing the standard of proof, the mental element, or any other elements of the crime. Prosecutors still have to prove physical injury to the highest standard available under law beyond a reasonable doubt. Rather, we are seeking a common sense solution for our most vulnerable victims. By supporting Senate Bill 1556, you will send a strong message of support to vulnerable Oregonians who are victims of violent crime. You have been heard, and we are here to see that justice is served. Thank you.
Chair Przyzowski, Vice Chair Cruz, my name is Kevin Barton, and members of the committee. I'm a senior deputy DA in the Washington County DA's office. I supervise our child abuse prosecution unit, and I'm also our district attorney's designee to chair our multidisciplinary team on child abuse. I was before you last year for basically the last version of this bill, and I want to thank you for considering it again. I'm aware of the Guzman case, and I think it's an excellent question as to why is this bill necessary despite this new case, Guzman, coming out. And what I'd like to say on that is I think Guzman is Exhibit A as to why this bill is necessary. So the Guzman case actually comes from Washington County, so I've had the advantage of speaking to one of the trial attorneys on that case and reviewing the exhibits from that case, including the photographs of the physical injuries in that case. And what I can tell you is that Guzman affirms something that has always been true, which is a jury is allowed to make reasonable inferences from the evidence, including a reasonable inference that a person may be in substantial pain by reviewing the evidence. Guzman is not the first case to say that, and certainly not the first case to say that in the context of physical injury. In fact, just 2 years prior, 3 years prior, there was a case called State versus Rennells that essentially said the same thing, except it said in that particular case the jury could not conclude there was a physical injury. The reason why Guzman is Exhibit A as to why this bill is necessary is it demonstrates the lack of uniformity on the issue as to when something is or is not a physical injury. Guzman contains things in that case that you won't find in the typical child abuse physical injury case. For example, in the Guzman case, the woman who was injured, who suffered injuries to her face, and you typically don't expect to see injuries to a child's face in a physical abuse case, although it happens typically when we're talking about corporal punishment, we're looking at areas that aren't always immediately observable. But in Guzman, the woman who was injured immediately sought the attention from two witnesses. One of the witnesses who she immediately came up to happened to be an expert in physical injuries. He was a mixed martial artist with years of training in martial arts and was able to testify in an expert capacity about his observations of her behavior and whether there was enough evidence to infer substantial pain from her behavior. There was a 911 call by the victim in Guzman where she was able to articulate what had happened to her, and that 911 call was received into evidence. So there are things in Guzman that you won't typically find when a child's injured. Children don't call 911 typically. It's very rare to have an expert on physical injuries on scene immediately after the injury occurs. It's very rare to have more than one witness who's there on scene immediately after an injury occurs. With child abuse cases, as you might imagine, we're dealing with things that happen behind closed doors in the family home, and we're typically dealing with punishment gone too far. And the nice thing about child abuse prosecution and child abuse protection is that people who are accused of doing things, there is a safety valve, and that's the defense of a reasonable parental discipline. So if there's any concern about this opening the floodgates to inappropriate prosecution or people going too far, we have a safety valve for child abuse cases that we don't have for other physical injury cases. You are not allowed to hit your wife, you're not allowed to hit your boyfriend, but you are allowed to hit your child under Oregon law as long as you don't go too far. And it's because of that safety valve that this bill is appropriate, because what we're doing here is we're protecting kids and setting a bright line to say that the Court of Appeals, if on Monday they say something is a physical injury, on Tuesday they say it's not, on Wednesday they say it is, that's no way to set a community standard for protecting kids. I'd be happy to answer any questions that anyone has regarding the bill, regarding the case law, or regarding the need for this. But I can tell you that developmentally delayed children and nonverbal children are the ones who were unable to protect because of the current state of the law. Guzman is of no help to us on that issue. It's just one more data point in the back and forth nature on what the law has been leading up until today. Thank you so much.
Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Rhodes. I'm the legislative liaison for the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, and I'm here today on behalf of the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office and the Oregon District Attorney's Association. In the interest of saving time for Dr. Leinhardt, who's traveled here from Portland, I want to keep my comments exceedingly brief and focused on the Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments, as you've heard from both Senator Monta Sanderson, who I want to reiterate thanks to her for bringing this bill, and also to Representative Olson, they narrow this bill in scope significantly. They are removing provisions that designate persons 65 and older automatically as vulnerable victims. We've met with many of the members in this building and heard concerns about that provision, and this was these were great concerns. What's good about the way that we've structured this bill, it refers back to the criminal mistreatment statute, and we can still use the dependent persons portion of that to cover any elderly persons that are dependent upon another for their physical care and so on and so forth. So that doesn't mean that elderly victims are left out in the lurch. It just means they aren't automatically designated as vulnerable if they are 65 or older. This bill also, the Dash 1 amendments also remove all reference to a reckless mental state, meaning there's no way these provisions could be applied to an eggshell victim, somebody that bruises too easily, or something of the like. This makes certain that we're only talking about intentional crimes. So with that, we're here to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Questions for this panel? Let me ask a general question and you can fill it. What I remember is the bill that we had this last session came as a result of the Wright decision. And so my reading of the Guzman decision, which for my colleagues, we've given you a copy of that so you can be familiar with the case. If we didn't have the Wright decision, would we have been here talking about changing or modifying or clarifying the term physical injury, first of all? And second, why doesn't Guzman address these concerns that were raised as to the reason for having clarification of what physical injury is?
I'd like to address that, Chair Brzezinski and Vice Chair Cruz and members of the committee. First question, if we didn't have Wright, would we have the reason for this bill? The reason would be here, but the motivation or the ability to articulate that reason to you may not be. What Wright had was something shocking. I think anyone who's seen those photos that I brought here last time has an immediate and visceral reaction to what you see. And just on a human gut level, putting aside all politics and who's a prosecutor, who's a defense attorney, who's whatever, anyone that looks at that kid and sees those injuries thinks, how in the world can any court anywhere say that that's not a physical injury? So if we didn't have those photos, I think we wouldn't be here today, because we wouldn't have the ability to articulate to you and the members of the committee the reason for the need for this change. So that's my answer to your right question. To answer the second question, and that has to do with, does Guzman essentially address the issue in right? And the answer on that is a little bit more difficult to articulate. So first of all, there are two pathways to prove a physical injury. Door number one is by showing an impairment of a physical condition. Door number two is by showing substantial pain. The Guzman case only addressed door number two. The Wright case only addressed door number one. So the two cases, while they both address what is a physical injury, they really deal with the two different paths to get to the one conclusion of whether something's a physical injury. And Guzman doesn't make any new law. It just provides one more data point on how you can get to what counts as substantial pain. As I mentioned before, there's another case called Rennells from 2012 that really articulated the same legal standard of a jury can infer or a judge can infer from evidence that something would be likely to cause substantial pain. But in that case, they said, no, this isn't enough. And those were bruises that lasted several days in Rennell. It was bruising lasting several days. The Court of Appeals said is not sufficient to infer substantial pain. So on one case, the Court of Appeals in 2012 said bruises lasting several days is not. On another case, Guzman in 2016, they say bruises on the face with some cut marks is. What's the difference? A 911 call, a mixed martial artist expert on physical injury who's on scene, facial injuries, and it's a domestic violence case. So we're not in a position where we typically see those facts that were in Guzman on child abuse cases. If we had Dr. Leinhardt present on scene from CARES Northwest immediately after the physical injury that these children incur, then we would be in the Guzman scenario because we'd have an expert on scene as they did in Guzman. We're not there. And so that's why Guzman doesn't help the problem. It's just one more example of the back and forth nature of what is or is not a physical injury. Thank you. Right.
Thank you for the clarification. I want to put these on the record so we can establish what the record says. So is it my understanding from your testimony that the individual, the witness that was with the martial arts was in fact qualified by the court to be an expert witness?
Well, I don't know whether the court, it's not always the case that a judge will say to a jury, I'm designating this person as an expert witness, Chair Przanski and Vice Chair Cruz. But what happens is the jury is told that, and the law is that any person with specialized knowledge can be an expert witness. So you don't have to be from Harvard, whatever school. You can be a mechanic and you can be an expert. So anyone with specialized knowledge in an area. And the Guzman court talked about how this gentleman who was on scene was a mixed martial artist who had 15 years of martial arts experience, including first aid experience. And he testified that based on his experience and his opinion, which would be an expert opinion, the victim's injuries have been recently inflicted. So it was that expert testimony which I think made the difference in Guzman. I'd like to just correct one thing that was said earlier, or amend one thing, I suppose, and that is that this bill, as it's currently proposed, would apply not only to intentional but also to knowing acts. So we're talking about purposeful acts rather than accidental or reckless acts.
Right. Thank you for the clarification. Any Senator Thatcher?
I just had a quick question on the on the amendment. It looks like it amends a different statute. And I also noticed the addition of something under section, it's on the fourth page, section four, intentionally or knowingly causing physical injury to a vulnerable victim because of the actor's perception of the victim's or the vulnerable victim's race, color, religion, et cetera. Is that just a LC clarification or?
Chair Przanski and Senator Thatcher, I can address that question. When we talked to legislative counsel about how to remove that reckless mental state to make certain that we didn't have the eggshell victim issue, we had to go through each statute where there might be a vulnerable victim applied in that statute and then adjust the reckless mental state. So when you see this section four, this is a crime that will normally have a reckless mental state attached to physical injury. We wanted to clarify that any time the state elects to use a vulnerable victim designation to prosecute these crimes, they have to prove it either intentionally or knowingly. They cannot use a reckless mental state. Okay. So that's what that reflects.
Thank you for the clarification.
All right. Thank you all very much. I'm going to go ahead and take the second panel. It looks like we're still on time. So the second panel is going to include Allison Kelly, Doug Riggs, and Dr. Dan McGarty? Leinhardt. Thank you all very much. Who would like to start first?
I can start. Good morning, Chair Persansky and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Allison Kelly, and I serve as the Chief Executive Officer of Liberty House, the Child Abuse Assessment Center that serves Marion and Polk Counties, one of two that serves Polk County. I am here today to support and be in concurrence of a position that the Oregon Network of Child Abuse Assessment Centers is taking on this bill, in support of this bill. And the reason is that the prior language in the statute was too narrow and did not really contemplate or allow for injuries that victims of child abuse often suffer. I believe that this bill, this provision that's been in front of you today, really improves access to justice for children. I would point out that a colleague of mine who is a director of another center in the state has said that what you have in front of you actually will bring in line the treatment of children to the same standard that we have the treatment of animal abuse. So we think that it's a good idea. I'd like to respond to one thing that I heard in the prior testimony that was so articulate and just mentioned that often we don't expect to see physical injury on faces, bruising and stuff on faces of children. I'd like to say that at Liberty House, we see children, small, medium, and large, with bruises on their face all the time. And it's not always related to discipline. It's very often related to the unmanaged anger of the adult in that child's presence at the time. So thank you for consideration of this testimony.
Thank you. And who's next?
Thank you, Chairman Persansky, Vice Chair Cruz, and committee members. My name is Dan Leonhardt. I'm the Medical Director of CARES Northwest, a Child Abuse Evaluation Center in Portland. My training and expertise is in the field of pediatrics, and I'm board certified in child abuse pediatrics, and I'm honored to be here today. When I was asked to provide testimony, I thought it would actually be important for me to provide accurate medical information that may be helpful in any deliberations on this bill, and information which I think supports defining bruising as a physical injury. First, there's a misconception that the presence of bruising without any other injury, such as a broken bone, indicates that the child was not subject to significant violent force. That simply is not true. Many of the children who I see who, quote, only have bruising have been subjected to extreme, potentially life-threatening violence. There's a video I saw when I was first starting my training. There was a toddler, and a mom had this toddler that was having some bruising. She didn't know how the toddler was getting it, thought she was getting out of the playpen. She put a hidden camera in the room. When she later checked the hidden camera, what she saw is that when she would leave, her boyfriend would go in and purposely inflict injury on the child. In the video, the child's thrown into the playpen, slapped repeatedly, punched, held down by the head, and systematically injured, even thrown across the room like a football. Every time I've watched that room in the video, professionals, district attorneys, physicians, detectives, people have to leave the room because it's so disturbing. The question they ask is, oh my God, what were her injuries? And the answer is surprising to a lot of people. She only had one small bruise on her abdomen. It was the only indicator of the severe trauma that she'd experienced. Recently in Washington County, a hidden camera showed a man choking a young child, hitting the child, lifting the child up by the neck, and throwing him to the ground. It was just as difficult for me to see that video. And again, there was only a small bruise that was present on that little boy. So as a result of these cases and countless others, the child abuse medical community understands this important truth, that because such violence can be inflicted without leaving bruises, when bruising is present, it often indicates that the child was subjected to really significant violence. Second medical point, we cannot misinterpret the ability of a young child to persevere through discomfort and pain as a sign that something painful didn't happen. Just because a young toddler with extensive bruising on his buttocks and back, like the Wright case, is walking around the next day, this does not minimize what he went through, nor does it tell us that he's no longer experiencing the pain from his injury. We should celebrate, not disregard, the resiliency of a toddler to laugh at Toy Story even though they can barely see the screen because their eyes are swollen shut from their bruises. Pediatric medicine tells us that young children can feel pain exactly the way as school-aged children do. The only difference is they can't verbalize that to us. So as a result, we must be their voices. Last year, before this same committee, I brought pictures that showed young infants whose bruises would not be considered physical injury under current Oregon law. I'm happy to provide those again. I hope that if you saw those, you reflect on those images and all the children that have been victimized since our last meeting as you consider this bill. As a pediatrician and a father, I'm proud to live in a state where its legislature has taken action to help protect child abuse victims through laws such as Carly's Law. By requiring that children with suspicious injuries are seen by a medical provider trained in child abuse, the law has saved lives, without question in my mind, and has ensured that bruising from medical problems, such as blood disorders, infection, and cancer, or bruising from normal active childhood, are not mistaken for what we're talking about today. I hope that you will continue to stand up and speak for our youngest and most vulnerable children by passing Senate Bill 1556. Thank you.
Thank you. Doug?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Doug Riggs on behalf of the Oregon Network
Doug,
of Child.
If you could move the mic
sure.
in front of you. Thank
sure.
you.
Again, Doug Riggs on behalf of the Oregon Network of Child Abuse Intervention Centers, and I really want to appreciate the time today. I'll be brief. I think the last two witnesses were really persuasive. I do want to say that we have 21 centers around the state that have worked extensively over the last 10 years with leaders like Senator Gelser and others to make sure that we have a system in place to identify and treat victims of child abuse. And in my mind, this bill is about that first term, identification. If you can't identify and make sure that something stands up in court, there's nothing we can do to protect those kids. So I really believe that this bill is a very essential effort, item in our effort to be able to protect children in this state. We do great work around the state. We had over 6,700 children seen last year at the 21 centers. As Allison mentioned, we see kids all the time with bruising. There's a spotty record from a prosecutorial standpoint, and so we really believe that this is a very important upgrade in the safety standards for kids in this state, and we hope that you'll pass it today. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any questions for the panel? Thank you all very much for coming and giving testimony. So I have one other person that's scheduled to give testimony, but I'm going to ask. This is Eric Dietrich. Eric, I don't know if you want to give testimony now or if you want to hold off on giving testimony. This bill and the next bill will not be able to be moved today. We do have a pretty full plate on 1550, and if you would like to just be on hold for your testimony on this one, we'll go to the next bill.
Chairman, I'm fine with being on hold and either later today if you're fine or next week.
All right. So we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing at this point, understanding that we will continue the public hearing. We will post it later today as required by the rules as to when we'll be fitting that in first of next week. And that will be for the purpose of taking Eric Dietrich's testimony, and then we'll go from there. So I'm going to close the public hearing on this one. And at this point, I think we're going to take a real quick break from doing the next public hearing. We're going to go into work session so we can take care of we have one bill that we can move, colleagues. We're still waiting on the paperwork on Senate Bill 1552, but I believe everything is ready to go forward on Senate Bill 1567. And if that's correct, I'm opening up a work session on 1567.
Excuse me.
And if we're going to do this, we have to take a subsequent call. Subsequent call.
Oh, we do? Okay. Okay.
And there's no amendments.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1567 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation and request a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 1567, excuse me, 67. Well, I saw the word subsequent underneath the other one. I said, wait a second, we're taking it off. 67 to the floor with a due pass recommendation requesting that the President's office consider removing the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Discussion. Any objections? So ordered. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1567. We'll Senator Thatcher will be our carry on 1567. And with that closed, we're not going to go back to our public hearings and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1550.
Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee, as you might recall, in the 2015 session, we had Senate Bill 822, which required recordation of grand jury proceedings. That measure was not enacted in 2015, but a work group met during the interim to consider improvements and modifications to that prior bill. And before you today, you have Senate Bill 1550. It requires all proceedings before a grand jury be recorded, either through digital means or by a certified shorthand recorder if requested. It staggers implementation across the state. It allows access to this recording or transcript by the prosecuting attorney or the defendant's attorney, or some limited access to an unrepresented defendant. It prohibits an audio transcript from otherwise being released if the grand jury returns a true bill, or if a not true bill in the case of a public servant. We have several other issues with this bill, including allowing the use of testimony for impeachment purposes, but it contains three areas in which a peace officer may give the testimony of another if a witness is under 15 years of age, if the witness has a disability that's preventing communication or understanding of a proceeding, or if the witness is a domestic violence victim. We have two amendments that should be up on OLIS for you at this time. There's the proposed -1 amendments, which makes several important but highly technical corrections. It also allows the prosecuting attorney to have earlier access to the audio or recording transcript, and it requires the prosecuting attorney to make specific requests on what information can be redacted when filing a protective order. It modifies the procedure for testimony from a peace officer in a grand jury proceeding to include statements, any statement that, if offered at trial, would otherwise be admissible under ORS 40.460, including the current domestic violence victim exception. The proposed -3 amendments remove the public servant disclosure provisions.
All right, thank you. What we're going to do is start off with various panels. The first is going to be just Gil Meyer to kind of, I guess, tee us up as to their presentation. And I will then go through the list as we have based on order of preference. And this also may be a bill, depending on how much testimony we take, may need to be carried over additional. We were allotted for an hour for this. We now have an hour and about 20 minutes, so I'm hoping that everyone keeps that in mind, that we'll be able to get everyone in so we will not have to ask people to come back. Gail, why don't you start off?
Thank you so much. Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee, thank you. Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, thank you for bringing your attention to this very important bill. I'd like to give you sort of a 30,000-foot flyover viewpoint of what it is that you're likely to hear and see during the course of the presentations, both by proponents and opponents, and give you an overview of what the witnesses might be addressing their comments to. This, of course, is occurring in the background of, it is by far and away the national norm that grand jury proceedings are recorded verbatim. We start from the premise that Oregon is the only state in the union that relies exclusively on the grand jury to initiate all of their felony prosecutions, and yet continues to rely upon handwritten notes written by a grand juror. 1550 is modeled after laws that are in effect and have been employed for many decades now in Alaska, Idaho, Nevada, and Hawaii. And you will be hearing testimony from practitioners on the prosecution side from Alaska and Idaho. I'd like to preview for the committee what I anticipate to be comments coming in opposition to the bill. And I say this only so that when you hear the testimony from the proponents, you can sort of tuck those comments under what I understand to be likely oppositional comments as well. Number one, I believe you'll hear a comment that there is no problem to be solved. There is no history or examples of grand jury abuse in Oregon. I anticipate you will hear that if recording is to occur, that it's important that Oregon convert their rules of evidence to then allow for hearsay testimony to come in through a police officer. It's called the case agent exception. You will likely see a chart that one of us up on OLIS already. We've seen that chart. Just know that it's very difficult to compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges when you're talking about grand jury laws. Technically, in our world, Oregon is a grand jury state, is a hearsay state. The question is whether it should be expanded to allow hearsay for the totality of all witnesses. You'll likely hear comments that if recording is to occur, it should be limited to simply the question and answers between the witness, but otherwise recording should be off when the prosecutor is otherwise in the grand jury room. And finally, you'll likely hear comments that if recording is to occur, that the defense attorney should not be given access to that record unless the defense attorney can show affirmatively that there's information on that record that's necessary to overcome a manifest injustice. You're going to hear in my hopeful lineup here of witnesses, four separate panels. You're going to hear prosecutors from Idaho and Alaska. You're going to hear from a group of grand jurors, some of whom will be calling in from around the state. You're going to be hearing from a group of crime victim advocates, both in Oregon and in Alaska, as well as the police coalition. And you're going to be hearing from a panel of defense attorneys. So with that, I thank you.
All right. Any questions for the preview? Thank you, Gail.
Thank you.
Our first panel includes the following. Jay Rosenthal and Ron Holden, I believe. Howland. And then we have two other individuals that are part of this panel that are going to be testifying by phone, if I understand that. So, gentlemen, whoever would like to go first, if you can give us your name for the record and then proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jay Rosenthal. I'm a career prosecutor, started in 1964, arrived in Idaho in 1981, and became a deputy prosecuting attorney for the Ada County Prosecutor's Office, which is in Boise, Idaho. I started out as the head of the Major Crimes Unit. Soon thereafter, with the increase in reports of child abuse cases, our office formed a vulnerable victim unit, which I headed for a number of years. Idaho is a state that not only uses the grand jury, but preliminary hearings. We, in 1981, codified and made rules concerning our grand jury, and those rules and statutes are in effect today. I have been asked to give my experience in running a grand jury and dealing with a grand jury in Idaho for the past number of years to assist in your determination on 1550, which is very similar to Idaho's bill. In light of the comments on the prior bill, it's interesting I helped establish Idaho's CARES unit at St. Luke's Hospital, which we use a great deal. In Idaho, all grand jury testimony, questions and answers are recorded. All advice given by the prosecutor or DA on elements, statement of the case, is recorded. All casual conversations, colloquy between prosecutors or DAs and jury members is recorded. Grand juries or grand jurors are identified only by number. Their names are sealed. There are questions about whether grand jury abuse occurs. As a supervisor for many years, not only in Ada County, but as a special prosecutor around the state, I can tell you that grand jury abuse does occur. It is not necessarily malicious or intentional. It's, in my view, frequently through inadvertence, casualness, because grand jurors and members of the prosecution are frequently members of the community who have either religious, social, business, or other views together in their conversations. Without having everything recorded, there's no way to determine whether grand jurors have been accurately advised as to the law or elements they're dealing with, and more importantly, whether comments are made directly or inadvertently concerning things that are prohibited by evidence rule 404B, such as character or other crime type evidence. I think recording is extremely important, and certainly in my role as a supervisor, it has been helpful in correcting inappropriate conduct by young deputies. In Idaho, no hearsay whatsoever is allowed. In my experience, that has presented absolutely no problem. Quite frankly, I found just the opposite. Even though preparing young witnesses is labor-intensive, I think and have experienced victims are able to testify in the non-adversarial environment of a grand jury. And quite frankly, their successful testimony frequently gives them confidence, it emboldens them, and in all honesty, the transcript provides the roadmap for them, and it's sworn testimony for not only them but the prosecutor to work with them if the matter has to go to a jury trial. The victim advocates I work with in Idaho strongly agree with that. Ada County was the first county in the state of Idaho to put victim witness coordinators in our office, and those individuals strongly support this. I frankly think there are more issues relying on hearsay testimony from officers telling what a young victim says than having that victim testify just because of different ways that information is passed on. I think it simply is not a wise idea. I realize there is a 14-year, under 14 hearsay is allowed. That's a decision folks here have to make. Obviously, I don't see it as being necessary. Again, the recording of grand jury testimony, I think, helps a great deal in plea negotiations. And shortens the process. We use either court reporters or digital recordings. The expense is not that onerous. Quite frankly, most of the testimony is on digital recordings, and they're relatively inexpensive to pass on, and rarely, in my experience, does the defense go on and have them transcribe. I realize there's a question of claims of intimidation of witnesses. Quite frankly, I think that's a false issue. It is rare in any crime charging that I've been aware of that the defendant does not know exactly who the complaining witness or witnesses are, and I see no difference in normal charging and having a grand jury. Overall, in my experience, the grand jury recording saves counties money and time and greatly assists in the resolution of cases through negotiation. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And Ron?
Chair Prozanski, my name is, and committee members, my name is Ronald Hohen. I am currently an attorney in Lakeview. I've lived in Lake County for 14 years. Prior to moving to Oregon, I began my legal career in the Ada County Prosecutor's Office. I went from the rookie in the office to the chief of the criminal division in 13 months. I was within the nation one of the youngest chiefs of a criminal division. I had to organize that. I had to form a way in which my young attorneys and myself, and I was very young at the time, had a philosophy of prosecution. I started the Major Crimes Unit and ran it. In fact, Jay took my place when I went to the U.S. Attorney's Office. And I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office for 16 years. I did many high-profile cases, primarily involving white supremacists, members of the Aryan Nations and Aryan Brotherhood and that type of thing. After that, I went to where my heart was. I went to Elmore County. It's the Cow County to the east of Boise and Ada County. I had a log home on the Snake River, and I really loved it. I was a chief deputy there. And after that, I went to the Attorney General's office. I traveled across the rural parts of Idaho. I assisted small county prosecutors, those without experience, in their most important cases and high-profile cases. I moved to Oregon in 2004. My mother was elderly. My wife's father was elderly. They were getting ill. And it's a 13-hour drive on a nice day from Boise to Central California. We decided to get as close as possible. We're 13 miles north of the border at Lakeview. And my mother passed 3 years ago. My wife's father passed this past November. We were down in California every other week to assist our brothers and sisters. Jay has commented about the Idaho rule. Idaho did not have grand jury by statute, at least in any workable form. The Idaho Supreme Court tasked a number of the attorneys, judges, and to formulate the rules of criminal procedure. One of those was Rule 6, which governs the recording of grand jury proceedings. Jay has mentioned the requirements there. I supported every one of those. And just to make an aside comment, I joined Jay in every comment he made here. I was a supervisor or the senior attorney. I've had to take care of younger attorneys who wandered off the reservation or really didn't understand office policy or violated what I understood to be the rules of evidence, the rules of ethics and professionalism. When I was on that committee, I had no experience with the grand jury. We didn't use grand jury. The statute was antiquated. It was a hodgepodge, and it just was unworkable. In order for me to be the representative of the Idaho Prosecuting Attorneys Association on that committee, there were two other elected prosecutors, and I recall there was a member of the Attorney General's office. I read every scholarly article I could find. I reviewed other states. I reviewed the ABA standards. And I think if you take a look at Gail Meyer's legislative testimony, you will see the summary of what I learned. When we took up grand jury recording, it took less than 15 minutes to resolve this. We had input from the defense attorneys on how important this is to justice, fair trials, and the truth. We heard from the judges who echoed this, former prosecutors, former criminal defense lawyers, and then it turned to me as the IPA representative. And I said, it's unanimous. We agree. We have no objection to any portion of this bill. We as prosecutors cannot do our job ethically and professionally without having this type of a bill. I commend your attention to Rule 3.8B of the Rules of Professional Conduct for prosecutors here in Oregon. Above any other attorney, any other judge, prosecutors over and above have special duties. That includes disclosing anything that tends to negate the guilt of the accused, anything that assists at sentencing, anything that undercuts the prosecution's case. These are the requirements every prosecutor has to comply with, federal and state. This is the reason why we agreed. No hearsay, various provisions, and if you get the time, or your counsel gets the time, take a look at Rule 6 of the recording provisions in Idaho. The costs. The Cow County I was in, Elmore County, less than $150 a year to record transcripts. We would train a farm wife, a mechanic. Here's a little device. You push the button, record. You push stop. You push pause. You have an ear jack in your ear. The red light comes on. Absolutely no problems with that ever. And we would take the cassette tapes. In our procedure, we'd be keeping the prosecutor's office. Perhaps it'd be better to keep them with the judges. You do not necessarily need a court clerk or a court reporter. That there's considerable expense there, but we found it was very easy to do. Currently, there is a black hole within the judicial system in the state of Oregon. My circuit court judge in Lake County has absolutely no idea what the district attorney is doing in front of the grand jury. There are statutes that were passed by your predecessors 50 or 100 years ago specifying the procedures and the protections for citizens. He can't enforce them. Why? There's no transcript. There's no ability for him to enforce those laws. I guess if you don't want to force them, why don't you repeal them? Just let the district attorneys do whatever they want. Judicial supervision of the grand jury process is critical. The judge gives to the jury their charge. He needs to remind them that they are an independent body. They are not a fiefdom of the district attorney or the prosecuting attorney's office. Independence is critical. When the framers of the United States Constitution considered how they would like to place between the crown and the colonists, they wanted to have a body of just plain folks. So the crown had to go through the folks. The Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution requires that grand jury body. And they wanted protection from the government, Washington, D.C., if you mean, the citizen, at the state constitution, between the state and the citizen. The preservation of the grand jury independence is critical because, as Jay has remarked, there are these, particularly in small counties like mine, you tend to know everybody, you tend to have relationships with them, and sometimes it's hard to resist having some kind of a personal relationship overtake the independence. Ronald Reagan very famously one time said, trust but verify. When you deal with the Soviet Union, trust but verify. The recording of grand jury proceedings permits the judge, permits the public, it permits the confirmation that grand jury proceedings are done correctly, pursuant to law, pursuant to statute, and I think it is very important for the verification of the very things that have been addressed here. This is not a Republican, independent, or Democrat situation. This is not a conservative or liberal type bill and issue. In 1981, I reached across the aisle and shook the hand of every defense attorney on that committee, every judge on that committee, and we agreed unanimously that this is how grand jury has to be recorded, and this is the procedures that are in that bill and must be followed. I ask you to do the same. I ask you to recommend to the others in the legislature that they reach across the aisle. Lastly, whatever bill comes out, and I know there are several, OC deal has proposed one, district attorneys have, perhaps there'll be others, but there's a lens I would suggest that you need to review each one of the bills, each paragraph, each section, each phrase, each word. That is, number one, how do we maintain the independence of the grand jury to make sure it doesn't become the fiefdom or it doesn't become part of the organizational chart of the district attorney's office? Number two, that we ensure judicial supervision. As my colleague, Mr. Rosenthal, has stated, judicial supervision is critical. As a supervisor, I have had to discipline younger attorneys within my office. I've had to suggest to some they need to find jobs other than in the prosecutor's office and give the judge the opportunity perhaps to weed out the occasional bad apple. It's normally not malicious, but sometimes some district attorneys yield to personal or political vendettas using through the grand jury process. Third, I was taught on ethics and professionalism. I teach. Mr. Rosenthal and I have taught within our office, within the Idaho Prosecuting Attorneys Association. We have also been on the faculty at the National College of District Attorneys in Columbia, South Carolina. Justice, fair trial, due process, the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. A completely open, recorded proceeding where not only the question and answers, but the colloquy, the discussions by the district attorney, who is the legal advisor to the grand jury, to make sure those elements of the crime are actually described, that if they're questioned by the grand jury, they are completely and accurately relayed to them.
Ron, I need you to be wrapping up. We're already okay. 20 minutes into this presentation. We have a lot of people that we still need to have a testimony from.
The last comment is, look it through the lens of Rule 3.8B and the Brady bill, the Brady decision. whichever bill, whichever amendment you care to take a look at, those four bases will give you an appropriate lens to guarantee to defendants their constitutional rights. And I think from both Mr. Rosenthal and I, there is no question that a prosecutor can accomplish each one of those goals by the recording process and making sure that everything statutory constitutionally is complied with. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for these two? Senator Thatcher first.
Excuse me. Yeah, right at the beginning you mentioned you do, in Idaho, you do grand juries and preliminary hearings, and I'm wondering which one is used most often and what's the determinant factor in deciding which process to use?
It's up to the prosecuting attorney. It is normally, the grand jury is normally used in vulnerable victim cases. Some jurisdictions use the grand jury in homicide cases, depending on certain circumstances, but it's up to the prosecutor. I personally use the preliminary hearing much more often than the grand jury. In my county, we do not have a sitting grand jury. We call the special grand jury for particular cases. Ada County, the city of Boise, has two sitting grand juries. They use them much more frequently.
I can say that in my experience as well, I prefer to use the preliminary hearing process when I was there. In fact, when I was there for 9 years, it was the only way that you could get an indictment or information. I preferred it because the witness came in, was examined, cross-examined, and I found in particularly my largest cases, and I prosecuted the North End rapist of Boise who raped over 100 women, and we got, I think, about 12 or 14 out of that number to come in and testify. They were terrified of coming to court. We worked with them. We had our female support staff meet with them. My wife met with them. And then what the best thing we did is we got all the young women together and we put them in a room, closed the door. After that, they went through the testimony and the cross-examination. Every one of them said, wow, that's not that bad. Now I'm ready to go to trial. And I preferred that. As far as the grand jury, we did it for an investigative grand jury, where you're taking testimony for days or weeks or months or even a year or more. That is the most appropriate use, in my opinion, of the grand jury. But like Mr. Rosenthal, my preference and the way I did it for many years is through the preliminary hearing.
I guess I have a follow-up. So to understand preliminary hearing, maybe is that recorded?
Oh, yes.
Or is that?
That's open court.
Okay, that is an open court.
That provision. That is an option here under current law.
Right.
I think you need to remember that Oregon courts are courts of record. From all the way from the Supreme Court to the Court of Appeals to the circuit court level, from the initial appearance all the way through trial and sentencing, it's all recorded. One judicial procedure, the grand jury, up till today is not recorded. And I can't understand it. And frankly, if you don't mind an aside, when I go back to Idaho and I talk to my prosecutor colleagues, my defense attorney colleagues, the judges I've known, they're shocked. They're stunned. The grand jury is not recorded here in Oregon.
Thank you very much.
So one other request for country boys, can we have a hat rack in here?
we'll work on that.
I had somebody sit on my Stetson once. So.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. It's not what you want to have.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much
for coming in and giving us your testimony. So we have two individuals that are going to be testifying out of this panel that are going to be by phone. So we're going to do the first one, which is, I believe, Regan Williams.
Good morning, this is Regan.
Good morning, Regan. This is Floyd Przonski. I'm the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Thank you very much for being available. We do have you on a speakerphone, as you can imagine. We're ready to take your testimony. If you can please first state your name at the beginning of your testimony and then proceed.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Regan Williams. It's R-E-G-A-N, Williams, common spelling. And I've been asked to relate my experience using grand jury audio in our prosecutions. And by way of background, I moved to Alaska in 2006 with the Attorney General's office. We were with a rural prosecution team that handled cases out of Barrow and Bethel, Kotzebue, and some of the remote parts of Alaska. Served in that capacity for 2 years, the assortment of more major cases in that role, and then transferred to the Anchorage District Attorney's Office from 2006 to the end of 2014. And in that time, we use almost exclusively the grand jury mechanism to bring these charges. And due to the remoteness of the state, much of the testimony from victims and witnesses would come via telephone, much like we're doing today. But everything would be recorded. And I had found it to be a very invaluable tool for the prosecution. It's the closest thing we had to a deposition. We could find a victim's testimony, witness's testimony at the scene, and have a very thorough record of what happened within a week or 10 days of a major incident. And this recording became the substantive evidence in the case. It captured the emotion. It captures the of the testimony itself. And when provided to defense counsel, when provided to the prosecutor team, if you will, we could look over over this record, over this document, and proceed from there. And in terms of plea negotiations, there just was nothing more valuable to provide to the defense than to have them right there experiencing the emotions of what occurred at grand jury. Another major component to the advantage of the prosecution was it's not uncommon for victims of domestic violence to change their testimony and recant. And so in Alaska, we're allowed to impeach these witnesses at jury trial with their prior inconsistent statement, and we can just gently play their statement from grand jury and let the trial jury compare the details of what was testified to at grand jury versus what they're hearing before them at trial. I can also comment that when I was promoted to the property unit supervisor, we had several instances, I say several, maybe two or three times a year, a prosecutor would misinform a grand jury about the law, about the, say, a specific requirement, and some of them are nuanced. For example, in order to have to be convicted of vehicle theft in the first degree, there has to be a showing of an intentional taking. In other words, it couldn't be somebody that borrowed a car too long. And so, but if a grand juror asked this question and the prosecutor wasn't aware of the law or that requirement, grand jury could be misinformed. And I remember two specific incidences where we would have to redo a grand jury because an improper standard was used. And so as a supervisor, this became a good tool for us. Again, there was nothing, they didn't mean to misadvise, they just weren't aware of a change in the law or case law. And so I did catch online part of Mr. Rosenthal's testimony, and to save time, I will just adopt. I was amazed at his, I just have the virtual identical remarks right down the line with what he had to say. I've never met them. I don't know them. But my observations and my experiences in those 8.5 years are right in line with his. The only difference I see is in Alaska, we use almost exclusively grand jury. In all my years there, we never used a preliminary hearing. I've heard of two being done, but we are exclusively grand jury here. And so I have found it not to be the use of audio recordings to be very helpful on all fronts, not expensive, it's easy, everyone has access to it, and we found it very helpful here. And that's the conclusion of my remarks, and if I may answer any questions, I'm happy to do so.
Regan, thank you very much. Let's see if there are any questions for Mr. Williams. There are not. Thank you, sir, very much. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Thank you so much.
Yep. Bye-bye. Our next witness scheduled is Amanda Woody, I believe, also out of Anchorage.
Thank you. is Amanda.
Good morning, Amanda. This is Floyd Przanski, Senator for and Judiciary Chair. Understand you're going to be giving us testimony today on Senate Bill 1550. Is that correct? All right. Thank you very much for being available. If you'll state your name for the record and then proceed.
Okay. My name is Amanda Woody. I currently live in Anchorage, Alaska. I previously worked as a deputy in court clerk in the 3rd Judicial District for Anchorage. During my time there, one of my responsibilities was to record grand jury proceedings. So that's what I was going to speak about a little bit today.
That would be great. Thank you.
Okay. So one of the things that's important to realize is that when recording grand jury's proceedings, there was a detailed protocol that we were to follow. Specifically, as soon as the district attorney entered is when we would go on record. Before then, there should be no communication between the district attorney and the jurors. Also, as I'm sure you're aware, the grand jury meets in secret. So the room was secured, meaning that the public couldn't enter and that other court personnel also couldn't enter. What this did was ensure confidentiality. I never in my time recording the grand jury ever experienced a time when a witness or a victim or even a grand juror was hesitant about being recorded. If anything, it was very routine, meaning that at any court proceeding at any time, the same exact setup would be in place with a deputy in court recording, a microphone at the witness stand, and a microphone at the podium. In addition to that, one of the things that I found was most interesting when Gail called me was that, and what I really wanted to let the committee know today is that during my entire time serving as a grand jury clerk, what I often heard over and over again from the grand jurors was that they really did appreciate having the entire proceedings recorded. And that's because at the beginning of each case that they would hear, they would be read many statutes, many definitions, and then it was up to them to true bill or not true bill. And having the proceedings recorded specifically allowed for transparency to happen during the proceedings. Jurors felt that everything was on the up and up. If anything, most jurors, you know, thought it was unusual that there was no defense attorney present, that they themselves were allowed to ask questions. But at the same time, I think it's also very, you know, it's very awkward to be reminded that you're meeting in secret, everything is very confidential, that the doors are locked, and the only person presenting evidence, of course, is the district attorney. So I really wanted to stress that there was, that it was very much appreciated to have it recorded. It was never cumbersome. It's something that in the state of Alaska, we record all of our court proceedings. And there was protocol to follow to ensure confidentiality at all times of the grand jurors, especially. So that's the majority of my testimony. I don't know if anybody had any questions.
Amanda, thank you very much. Let's see if are there any questions for Ms. Woody? There's not. Thank you very much for your time. Hope you have a wonderful day.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. So our next panel is going to have, and John, I'm going to unfortunately probably butcher your last name, Baltvizio?
Baltvizio.
Okay, close, but not quite. And then we have two other individuals in this panel who are also going to be appearing by phone. And just as a time check, if you can keep your comments from, let's say, being repetitive and maybe just agree with others, if they've already said what you're a part of it, that would help us to make certain we get through everyone today.
Okay. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is John Baldovieso, and I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 1550. I'm a programmer for a nonprofit based in Portland, and in October 2012, I served on the Multnomah County Grand Jury Number 2 for 4 weeks. We spent five half days a week hearing somewhere between 75 and 100 cases, primarily drug offenses. And I served as the clerk of that grand jury, taking notes on all the cases. And I learned really quickly that I had to choose between paying attention and taking good notes. My notes became pretty terse over the course of the 4 weeks, and I was just capturing some names and a few scant details from each witness. I pretty much only write by hand these days when I'm signing a check, so my handwriting is pretty bad. I'd be pretty embarrassed if any of these notes had to be pulled and I had to try to figure out what I'd written. And I like to think that I'm not the only person for whom that's true. So in my opinion, being able to hit record and sit back and absorb the testimony would be a significant improvement in the quality of the record and also the amount of attention I could pay to what I was doing at the time. Another reason that's been alluded to already is the transparency this would bring. During my time on the grand jury number two, I found that the Multnomah County deputy district attorneys presenting cases were extremely professional and ethical. However, they were relied upon to self-police themselves and essentially run the entire grand jury process. The grand jury's relationship with them from the first day became really collaborative, not really skeptical. As someone with no legal background, I was partly deciding what was important in testimony based on the general coaching of the deputy DAs at the beginning of the whole process. So if that testimony were recorded, it would bring a lot more transparency and I wouldn't have to make those judgment calls. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you very much for coming to the Capitol today and All right. giving your testimony. Our next person is going to be by phone. I believe it's going to be Ron Morrison. I got it wrong.
Roy.
Hello, Roy. This is Floyd Przonski. I'm the senator, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. I understand you have been asked to give testimony today on Senate Bill 1550.
Yes.
And I'd like for you to do that. If you'd please just state your name for the record. It is being recorded, as you can imagine, and we'll take your testimony.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yeah, my name is Roy Morrison, M-O-R-R-I-S-O-N, and I was a worked for the city of Klamath Falls from 1982 to 2007 when I retired. Started out at the airport fire department from 82 to 88. I was cross-trained as a police officer in 1984, transferred to the PD in 1989. Worked patrol, narcotics, fire arson investigator, motor officer, investigated many crimes and testified many times in grand jury. As I said, I'm now retired and living in Baker City. I had the opportunity to serve on a grand jury for Baker County January through April of, I believe, 2014, and I was elected foreman of that grand jury. My concerns were that some of the cases that were brought before us basically had incomplete investigations, and the officers that were testifying weren't the officers that were investigating. They were assisting officers. For some reason, the investigating officers weren't available. And so, you know, some of them were sent back for a complete investigation. And I would hate to think that another grand jury that didn't have, you know, basically my previous experience would have let some of that stuff through. I have read Bill 1550, and I'm aware that it would require recording. And I think that would be a great deal, as one of the other people said, that, you know, you had to split your time between listening to the testimony and you know, taking notes, and I would take a look at my notes also. I know that there are opponents of the bill that would want to convert it to a hearsay state, where an officer would just come in and basically read their report. As far as I'm concerned, they should just give the report to the grand jurors and let them read it, because they're going to get as much out of it. When you're taking a testimony, as you're well aware, you need to be able to see the person, hear the person, you know, see their body language, hear their voice. You just don't get that from a report. And, you know, you can make a police report indicate guilt or innocence just in the wording or the inflections that you use when you read it. The media is a great way to show that. I know there was another section in there that talked about recording only the testimony part, not the deliberation part, and I consider that ridiculous. If you're going to record the proceedings, record the entire proceedings. You know, there shouldn't be anything to hide in the deliberations. There shouldn't be anything to hide in the entire process. That's about it.
All right. Mr. Morrison, thank you very much. Ms. Meyer has come up to the dais for something.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers. I'm wondering if we could ask Mr. Morrison to clarify his comment. I don't believe he verbalized exactly what he said, something about recording the deliberations. And I would like for him to clarify, is he really suggesting that the bill should require recording of grand jury deliberations, or was he meant to indicate record instances when the district attorney is in the grand jury but not questioning a witness?
This is where you say objection leading. All right.
Just to clarify, I think. Yeah.
Mr. Morrison, for clarification, when you made the statement of recording the deliberations, you were not inferring that the deliberations of the grand jury when they were deciding whether or not to return a true bill or not should be recorded, were you?
Yes. I thought I read something in there where they were talking about just the testimony, not the deliberation. The way I feel, everything should be recorded from the time you get into to hear the case, to the instructions given, the testimony, the deliberations. There shouldn't be any hiding behind anything. Everything should be recorded so that it's there, because there may be some questions that come up in the deliberations that maybe the prosecutor can elaborate on or clarify at some point.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Let me just see if there's any questions from any of the senators for Mr. Morrison. Mr. Morrison, thank you very much for your time this morning, and hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you, sir. You also.
Yeah, bye-bye. Our next witness is going to be Justin Gibbs. While we're getting Mr. Gibbs on the phone, there will be a couple of people I'm going to be skipping over that are here on a regular basis, so I can make sure we get people who are not here on a regular basis.
Hello.
Good morning. Is this Justin Gibbs?
This is Justin Gibbs.
Hello, Mr. Gibbs. This is Floyd Przanski. I'm the state senator who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee. I understand you've been asked to give testimony today on Senate Bill 1550.
Yep.
And if you're ready, if you will give us your name for the record and then your testimony, sir.
Okay. My name is Justin Gibbs, G-I-B-B-S. I live in Pendleton, Oregon. I have gone through school up to the 12th grade. I graduated from Pendleton High School. I served on grand jury in Umatilla County for 3 months from October 2015 to January 2016. I believe that grand jury proceedings should be recorded because I feel that it is important to make sure someone else besides the grand jury has the ability to make sure everything goes on in the grand jury room is in fact true, accurate, and legal. During the first week I sat at grand jury, a sheriff's deputy testified that using someone's debit card, even with the owner's permission, is identity theft. I couldn't believe that was right. I have often used someone else's debit card with permission, and I have never believed that would be identity theft, or vice versa. If someone else used my debit card, there was a bit of discussion between the grand juries about this, and other grand juries agreed with the sheriff's testimony. I later asked an attorney, and that attorney told me that the deputy sheriff was wrong, that using someone's debit card with their permission is not identity theft. That left me very confused and worried. We did have a case come before us where this was important. We were asked to indict someone who had been using a debit card with the owner's permission. No one ever told us that it was identity theft, that it wasn't identity theft. And so we indicted that person. Since my grand jury team was up, I have again been told by an attorney I know that using a debit card with the owner's permission is not identity theft. I am now thoroughly confused, and I feel badly that perhaps we indicted someone on a false understanding of the law.
All right, Mr. Gibbs, anything else that you want to share with us?
Yes, I have one more little paragraph to read.
Okay.
This is too much responsibility to put on the grand juries alone. We are not lawyers. We do not know what's legally true and what isn't. If the grand jury were recorded, at least we could feel relaxed and sure that someone else would be checking the accuracy of what goes on in the grand jury room. Thank you for this chance to share my thoughts. That's it.
All right, Mr. Gibbs, thank you. Let me see if there's any questions for you. Is there any questions from the panel? Mr. Gibbs, thank you again for your time, and I hope you have a wonderful day.
Okay, thank you. You too.
All right, bye-bye. All right, so we're going to drop down and take our next telephone witness. It's out of, let's see, it's Tamara DeLucci.
Hello, this is
Tamara. Hi, this is Floyd Perzanski, state senator who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee. And I understand that you were been requested to give testimony today on Senate Bill 1550?
Yes.
And your last name, is it DeLucci?
DeLucia.
Mr. DeLucia, if you'll give us your name for the record and then your testimony, we would appreciate that.
Greetings, members of the committee. My name is Tamara DeLucia, and I'm on the line to speak in favor of Senate Bill 1550, the recordation of grand jury proceedings. I'm speaking as an individual with 16 years' experience as an appellate prosecutor and a victim advocate. For the past 9 years, I've been an appellate prosecutor with the State of Alaska Department of Law. I handle primarily sexual assault, child sexual abuse, and domestic violence cases. Previously, I was the senior attorney and interim director of the Alaska Office of Victims' Rights, which is an office within the state legislature charged with oversight of criminal cases statewide to ensure protection and enforcement of constitutionally protected victim rights. And I began my career as a trial prosecutor for the municipality of Anchorage handling domestic violence cases. The Alaska grand jury process has its origins in the state constitutional convention, and Alaska has always recorded verbatim the grand jury proceedings and transcribe those proceedings in written form just as a trial transcript is done, although grand jury transcripts are kept confidential and released only to the parties in a case. The identity of the grand jurors is protected, and deliberations are always kept confidential and not recorded. In my experience, recordation does not negatively impact victims. The grand jury proceeding generally occurs within a very short period of time from the actual crime versus the trial that can occur many months later. The contemporaneousness of the grand jury proceeding for the crime means that generally the victim is forthcoming and has clarity of memory and a desire to testify. It's also a nice preparatory experience for the victim in that there is an official proceeding in front of a jury with a prosecutor asking questions, but it's non-adversarial, meaning there isn't a defense attorney questioning the victim, so it's almost a practice run for the victim in a safe environment. In my experience, victims assume recordation is taking place just as it would in a regular trial proceeding, and I have never had a concern that that process or practice has a negative impact on victims or witnesses. Moreover, as a career prosecutor, it's my experience that recordation is beneficial from a prosecutor's perspective. It allows you to flesh out the strength of your case, as the grand jury is a powerful investigative tool. Additionally, providing witnesses with their grand jury testimony prior to trial is helpful to minimize recantation and provide an opportunity to clarify ambiguities during the trial preparation process. to the extent a witness's trial testimony varies from their grand jury testimony, the written grand jury record can be used to refresh or rehabilitate a trial witness. And prior to trial, the written grand jury record is a useful and powerful tool in the plea negotiation process. It's helpful for a defense attorney to understand that a witness has cooperated with the government and has testified consistently with charges alleged in the indictment and will similarly testify at trial. In this way, the time and expense of trial may well be avoided by a simple recordation of the grand jury proceeding. Given the inherent limitations that you've heard from other grand jurors that have testified before you today of your current practice of relying on handwritten notes, and given that recordation has really no discernible negative impact on witness testimony or prosecutor practice, I see no advantage to retaining your current practice and recommend converting to a verbatim recordation process as is standard in most other states. Thank you for your time. I'm open to questions from the committee if there's any additional concerns.
All right. Thank you. Let me just see from the panel. Yes, we do. Senator Thatcher.
This is what I'm hearing for people that don't want to open up this to, you know, our grand juries to recording. They're saying that to cross-examine the victim, I mean, they already have an official statement online or I guess public statement already made to the police. They have detective reports. And they're seeing that, you know, the more times a victim has to restate, you know, their victimization, that it gives, because it's difficult to retell, you know, the same story exactly the same every time, that they're concerned that it would just victimize the victim further, because then they could be made out to be a liar in court, which is another, you know, way to be victimized. And then they're also worried that having to tell their story so many times adds to the trauma. I'm just wondering if, and so they're proponents of, rather than having the victim testify in these grand juries, to have somebody else. I mean, I guess that's where the hearsay comes in.
The case agent.
And, yeah, the case agent. So I'm wondering, have you ever run into a situation where the victim would rather their case agent told their story, and were you able to do that? Were you able to allow that?
Yeah, so we do allow hearsay testimony in grand jury proceedings, and I just had a case where the victim was completely reluctant to testify, refused to say anything on the record. She just would say she didn't remember or she didn't know, even when confronted with her statements to law enforcement officers. And what was interesting about that case is, yes, we took the testimony of the officers in that case, and they established the elements of the crime and the probable cause, for, you know, and we did get a true bill. But what was more interesting about that is the grand jurors understood what was happening, and they were concerned for her personal safety and the fact that she was recanting so much. And they questioned her directly, saying, do you realize we want to help you? We want to know if you have a safety plan. Forget about what's happening in this room. As human beings, we're worried about you and your children. And I think that's an important and powerful tool, too, because a victim is not being victimized in that room. A grand jury proceeding is going to occur whether you record it or not. So the recordation is not what's victimizing your victim. It's the fact that, you know, what you're hearing is that the fact that she has testified is the victimization. But this is the safest place she's going to testify. She doesn't have adversarial attorneys questioning her. She has a safe space where grand jurors are actually looking at potentially adding additional charges that the state maybe didn't even bring, where grand jurors are concerned for her well-being and her safety, and where, yeah, you know, we can have the case officer testify, but the most powerful tool is going to be her own testimony. If she recants and you have a recorded record where she's recanting or saying that nothing happened, it's not as useful for the prosecutor, but I think it's useful for that victim to go through the process and realize that this isn't going to be catastrophically scary. I think it's a lot worse to walk into a courtroom having no idea what's going to happen and be questioned by a defense attorney under oath about your veracity, your memory, and all of that, if you haven't gone through a grand jury proceeding where you have a safe space to tell your story and all you have is the government there to support you in, you know, trying to find justice. Does that seem to answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. So, but you do still allow case agents to testify on behalf of a victim, while
we do. We have limited limited opportunity for that to happen. The victim has, you know, under Crawford, we have to have, there has to be some sort of opportunity for the victim to tell her story. So we have to put her on the stand. We have to ask her the questions. If she declines to answer the questions, we can bring the case officer in as a hearsay witness. And then we also allow child victims to avoid grand jury by having their first report put into the record.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. Let me see if there's any other questions. I don't think so. Tamara, thank you very much. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, so we're going to call up another panel. First, we're going to put on the phone Vicki Moffitt, and while we're getting her on the phone, I believe it's Jason Thompson, Walter Todd, and Krista Shipley? Shipley? Sipsey? If you three would come forward.
Senator Walter Todd's not present. Mr. Shipsey and Mr. Thompson, two clients who would like to show.
Yeah, we're going to just take the attorneys at this point, and they can refer to their clients in their testimony. We're doing time management here. As you remember, we said an hour for your presentation. We're now an hour into it, and we've still got a lot of people to cover.
This is Vicki.
Good morning. This is Floyd Przanski, State Senator, Chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I'm assuming this is Vicki Moffitt?
It is. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Doing well.
Thank you very much for being available to us by phone. If you'd give us your name for the record and your testimony would be appreciated.
Certainly. Thank you. Good morning, Senators. My name is Victoria Moffitt. I am a criminal defense attorney, and for the past 18 years, I've practiced primarily in Union, Wallawa, and Baker counties. I am primarily a public defender on contract with the Office of Public Defense Services. Over the years, I've had a number of cases where lack of access to grand jury testimony significantly impacted my ability to represent a client, and I'd like to relay a recent experience as just an example. I just finished representing a man charged with three felony sex offenses, two of which were Measure 11 charges carrying mandatory minimum sentences of 100 months and 75 months. The charges involved his encounter with an adult female and were based on her allegations of physical helplessness. Early on in the case, the deputy DA actually came to me and asked me to make what he termed a creative offer, one that would not require my client to register as a sex offender. That indicated to me that he'd consider a misdemeanor offer, since felony sex offenses require registration, and it is almost unheard of for a DA to even consider resolving a ballot Measure 11 sex case as a mere misdemeanor. Now, I knew that the state had some significant problems with their case. The complainant was a convicted felon and a drug addict who was under investigation for more felony charges at the time that she made her statements. Four police officers, two deputies, a sergeant, and a detective had investigated the case, and they had interviewed the complainant, served a search warrant at my client's home, and conducted a thorough interview with my client. And in the end, those officers concluded they had no probable cause to arrest my client. And yet 4 months later, the DA took the same case to the grand jury and obtained an indictment. The DA later informed me that the complainant had made some contradictory statements in her testimony to the grand jury regarding her use of controlled substances at the time of the incident. And although I didn't know what she had actually said, her story was clearly compelling enough that the grand jury indicted my client on these very serious charges, despite the fact that just months before, the experienced investigating officers had determined there was no probable cause to even believe a crime had been committed. My client had professed his innocence and pled not guilty, so I began to prepare for trial. But not knowing what the witness had said to the grand jury placed my client at a significant disadvantage throughout this case. First, in preparing the case for trial, I was limited in my ability to craft thorough cross-examination questions for the witness or to perhaps locate additional witnesses or evidence that may have been relevant. Second, during the plea negotiation process, I was dealing with a deputy DA who knew full well what the weaknesses were in his own case, whereas I was forced to speculate as to why the state was proceeding in such an unusual manner, and thus my client and I were forced to use our best guess during negotiations rather than making informed decisions based on all the facts.
And finally, in terms of actually deciding how best to proceed, not knowing the whole story placed my client in a difficult position. If he continued to profess his innocence and took his case to trial, he risked the possibility of 175 months in prison. On the other hand, being able to resolve the case with a plea to a misdemeanor that was not a sex offense and thus not registrable seemed like too good an opportunity to pass up. And in the end, the risks of trial were simply too great, and principle gave way to practical. The state requested a settlement conference, and we ultimately resolved the matter as a misdemeanor harassment charge. As a defense attorney, it is my obligation to make sure that my clients understand the legal process, their rights, the risks involved in taking a matter to trial, and the benefits of resolving a case with a plea offer. And to do my job well, I must know everything that the state knows, the good, bad, or otherwise, so that I can adequately advise my client on all possible courses of action. It's simply an issue of fairness. Justice shouldn't be a game of hide and seek where one party has all the facts and the other is left to guess as to what those facts may be. Recording grand juries and providing that testimony to the defense simply gives defendants and their attorneys equal access to relevant facts, specifically what a witness actually had to say after she took an oath and swore to tell the truth. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Let's see if there's any questions. I don't believe there are any questions. So, Vicki, thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too, Senator.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Goodbye.
All right. So who would like to go next?
I'll go first. Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Cruz, Jason Thompson. I'm a partner here in a firm in Salem, Furter Case for French and Thompson. I practice primarily criminal defense work at this point. I'm a former prosecutor, also a former law clerk at the Oregon Supreme Court. I'm not going to add too much to why I think this would be a great bill. I know you've heard a lot of information already. I would basically chime in on that. We do have Ms. Gypsy and I both just got done with a case in Yamhill County where the charges were dismissed just on the eve of trial. Our position is that had grand juries been recorded, it would have probably never even been charged. Ms. McMullen is in the back of this room as well, Yamhill County resident. It was basically a dispute with her former employer. There was information that was exculpatory that we know that was exculpatory that was in the police reports, was never presented to the grand jury. My position would be simply that if grand juries were recorded, that type of practice would not be manipulated by prosecutors in certain circumstances. Again, all of the charges were dismissed just on the eve of trial. Unless the committee has any questions, I don't have anything else to add. I know you've heard a lot of information this morning.
All right, Jason, thank you. Any questions? Thank you. Krista?
Good afternoon. I also have my client, Linda Hickson, is in the courtroom today. This trial was dismissed, and I believe that – I'm sorry?
Your name for the record.
I'm sorry, Krista Shipsey.
Thank you.
I too, believe that this case would have been dismissed had we had the grand jury information. I think without grand jury recording, there are two significant impacts. One, there's an inefficient use of judicial time. In this case, we were provided with thousands of pages of documents regarding the discovery. We were unable to ascertain from those documents what the theories of the theft charges were. Because of that, shortly before trial, we were forced to file legal documents, file demurs, forcing the prosecutor to determine what or to let us know what their theory of the charges were. That necessitated a half day of court time. Had we had those grand jury recordings, we would have known what the theory that the prosecutor was going to be going on. Also, had I had those and known what their theory was, I would have been able to give the prosecutor the appropriate witness statements, which I ended up doing shortly before trial when I was finally able to get the prosecutor to tell us what the theories were. The day after giving the prosecutor all of that information, these cases were dismissed. It cost our clients a lot of money, many months of emotional turmoil, and needless damage to their reputation. And I think all of that would have been avoided had we had this information at the outset of the case.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Thatcher.
Just real quick. I just want to understand. You were an attorney for the defendant?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you all very much for coming forward. So we're right at a point here. What I want to do is go through the list that we have of individuals to give testimony. I've looked at it to see how far some of the individuals may be. So those who've signed up, well, I'm going to try to just do it by raise of hands. If you are not able to be here on Tuesday of next week, I'd like for you to please raise your hand. I want to try to get as many of those individuals up I'm not sure who just raised their hand. Why don't you go ahead and come on up? And then, Dinah, I know that you're scheduled to give testimony. I know you live over 100 miles. I don't know if you're planning to be here on Tuesday.
Tuesday.
Okay. So, Aaron, why don't you go ahead and go first, and then we'll figure out, because we will be able to pick up with two or three more people for sure.
Thank you, Senator Przanski. Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Olson. I'm an attorney in private practice, and for the last 12 years, I've represented crime victims in criminal and civil cases. For the 10 years before that, I was a prosecutor. I've practiced criminal law in five separate jurisdictions, in three of those as a prosecutor. Those three jurisdictions were Oregon, Massachusetts, and the federal government. All of those three jurisdictions use the grand jury system, and in two of those jurisdictions, the feds and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, we used court reporters, stenographers who typed out grand jury testimony to record the grand jurors. I'm not here to ask that you reject grand jury testimony outright because I think it serves a legitimate public purpose. But I am here to urge you to modify the bill to permit hearsay evidence as most other jurisdictions do. And that's to protect victims. It's also for some practical reasons that you'll probably hear about from others. If you do not choose to allow hearsay in most cases, then please provide meaningful access to protections for victims in these cases and for witnesses. Under Oregon's current system, victims and witnesses typically know that they're not going to be recorded in the grand jury. And that's important to victims who are facing seven strangers. They have to tell what happened to them, usually something that's the worst experience of their life, to seven strangers in a conference room. It's a private setting, and the fact that it's not recorded gives them some comfort, whatever minimal comfort that may be. That their abuser does not get to hear the fear in their voice and perhaps hear them crying as they recite what happened to them is also some small comfort. And the way that this bill is drafted at present, those comforts go away because the criminal defendant is going to get to hear in what the victim has to say, hear the emotions, and I've heard some testimony that that may be beneficial for plea negotiations, but I don't think that's the purpose of recording grand juries. Printed words are also less likely to incite a criminal defendant if he's hearing or if he's reading written words rather than hearing the emotions of the victims and the witnesses. My primary concern with the bill is the protective order provision. It was put in to placate victims' advocates, but it really is precatory because most victims have no attorneys. And you really need an attorney if you're going to go in and seek a protective order from a judge in a criminal case. There are exactly four attorneys in the state of Oregon whose job it is to represent crime victims in criminal cases. Rosemary is one. There are three others who work for her organization. So to put in a provision that really has no meaning for the vast majority of crime victims, I would ask you to reconsider and either do something else to protect crime victims or give crime victims meaningful access to attorneys so that they can use the protective order function that you've put into this bill. I think there's a lot more work to be done to this bill, mostly for practical reasons. The provisions for the release of grand jury records don't contemplate substantial and compelling reasons that there will be to release grand jury recordings in cases that have been withdrawn by prosecutors from the grand jury. And I think that there should be a provision that there should be access to grand jury recordings and substantial and compelling reasons, not just in true bills or not true bills, but also in cases that the prosecutor chooses to withdraw. And I know that I diverge from the prosecutor's position in that regard. I also think there needs to be clarity in when pro se defendants have access to these recordings if you're going to allow or require victims and witnesses to testify in person, because pro se defendants can do all sorts of mischief if they have the actual recordings. And I think that if you were to not give them the recordings, you would be facing some other constitutional challenges. I think that there's been no discussion of the practical reality that there will be motions to dismiss that will arise from recording grand juries. That is real. In Massachusetts, where I practiced for 4 years as a prosecutor, a standard motion at the outset of a criminal case was a motion to dismiss, even though the law said that the adequacy of testimony of evidence before the grand jury could not be a basis for dismissal of the indictment, just as it says here in Oregon. But practically speaking, the right to due process requires that there be some evidence presented on each of the elements. And so there would be McCarthy motions. That was the case that it arose from, filed in many cases. There are also motions filed to dismiss on the grounds that there was exculpatory evidence that would have changed the outcome of the grand jury deliberations had it been presented. So practical reality is there will be motions to dismiss, notwithstanding the efforts put into the bill to prevent motions to dismiss based on what was presented to the grand jury. For those reasons, I think that while the bill is justified, that is, recording grand juries is a fine thing to want to do, I think that this bill just needs more work.
All right, thank you. Who would like to go next?
Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee, my name is Rosemary Brewer, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Crime Victims Law Center, a nonprofit organization that provides free legal representation to crime victims. Our organization has represented victims throughout Oregon on issues ranging from privacy rights to the right to protection and the right to be heard. I'm testifying today to ask the committee to carefully consider the provisions of Senate Bill 1550 and perhaps reconvene a work group that would include victims' rights attorneys and advocates before moving this bill forward. At the outset, I'd like the committee to know that before moving to Oregon, I was a prosecutor in two other states that did record grand jury proceedings. I'm not opposed to grand jury testimony being recorded. However, in both states where I worked, a hearsay exception applied to grand jury testimony. The majority of felony cases were presented to grand jury by case agents, generally either the responding officer or a detective. It's a simple, efficient, and effective method for presenting cases that not only gives the grand jury the necessary information, but it also protects the victims in the case from additional trauma and from potential retaliation by the defendant. The bill as it's written now contains inadequate protection for victims. While there is a protective order provision, the burden is on the victim to seek that order. This burden should not be on the already traumatized and likely unrepresented victim. Asking the victim, who has likely been through the most harrowing experience of his or her life, to prove why they don't need their testimony turned over to the defense just re-victimizes that person and puts one more hurdle up in the quest for justice. The fact is that not all victims will get notice that they can ask for a protective order, or know how to proceed if they do, or know how to find an attorney who will help them file for a protective order. Instead, there should be an automatic protective order on victim testimony, and the defendant, who has counsel, should have to file a motion to get that testimony and provide notice to both the prosecution and the victim to do so. The fact remains that even if a victim is successful in getting a protective order, those orders do not always prevent a defendant from getting protected information. My office recently had a case in which the court imposed a protective order on the child victim's interview with CARES Northwest. Despite that order, the defense attorney gave the defendant a copy of the child's interview, which the defendant then sent out to family members. Protective orders do not sufficiently protect a victim's privacy. The hearsay exception in this bill for children younger than 15 and those with an intellectual disability does not go far enough. There are many vulnerable victims, regardless of age or disability, who need the protection afforded by a hearsay exception for all victims. Victims of sexual assault, elder abuse, domestic violence, and gang violence are susceptible to intimidation and harassment by offenders. And as a society, we should strive to protect this vulnerable population. Oregon should follow the example of 45 other states, as well as the federal government, and allow case agents to testify on behalf of victims and witnesses. Thank you.
Thank you. Steve?
Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, Steve Dole with Crime Victims United of Oregon. 7 short years ago, you had a bill in front of you that was House Bill 3508. At the time, Crime Victims United, the ODAA, and other organizations saw a problem with that bill. We told you at the time that that bill was a bill that was headed for disaster because it was going to release violent criminals because of an early release provision in the bill. The proponents of the bill were told this. The committee counsel at the time was told this. And they didn't do anything about it. That action resulted in a homicide that happened in Washington County. young woman by the name of Stephanie Dusa was killed by a person who was on release by the name of Justin Hookey. So let's get down on the ground and talk about human beings here. I heard a lot of chest thumping and desk pounding about recording grand juries this morning from gentlemen from Idaho and Alaska and what have you. We don't have any problem with recording grand juries. We said as much last session. Record until the cows come home. What we're asking for is very simply what 44 other states do and the federal government, and that's provide for hearsay by case agents for crime victims who are vulnerable and don't want to testify. They're scared of the defendants. They're scared of the defendants. These are domestic violence victims. Do you want to see these domestic violence victims further injured in another assault or worse? Because that's what happened when we didn't pay attention. That's what happened to Stephanie Dusa. We didn't take the advice of crime victims, the district attorneys, and other people who said, don't do this. We're saying, record, fine. But for vulnerable victims, whether it's domestic violence, whether it's a homicide situation, whether it's an assault, burglary of an elderly couple, sexual abuse of young children where the mother is scared to death of the perpetrator, or a rape victim, allow them to have case agents testify for them so they are not further victimized by the system and by the defendant. I gave you, you have three documents up there. The first one, probably the most important one to read, is by a woman named Angela Foster. Angela couldn't be here today, but she had to appear in front of a grand jury. Her young son was murdered by her husband. He was a twin about, I think, 4 years ago now. I'd encourage you to read her statement, and she wished she could be here today. The second is by Doug Ballouf. Doug is a professor of law, and he is the at Lewis and Clark Law School, and he is the founder of the National Crime Victims Law Institute. The last is a op-ed that I wrote last session regarding medical records. I want to make it clear one more time. We encourage, we support recording grand juries. What we don't want to do is create more victims here. Please put in a provision for hearsay. Former Attorney General Hardy Myers had a saying in his office. He had a slogan. Every victim, every right, every crime, every time. And that's what we should be doing here. Not some victims based on age, not some victims based on type of crime or event, but Hardy Myers' slogan, every victim, every right, every crime, every time. We're on an island, folks, with a couple other states when it comes to this issue. We can be headed to the mainland and be doing the right thing by doing what 44 other states and the federal government does, by providing hearsay through case agents. Or we can swing the boat around the other way and we can go to another desert island where we will be absolutely alone. We will be an outlier by just providing for this protective order, which I think you heard is almost not worth the papers that it's printed on. Thank you very much.
Questions for anyone? Senator Thatcher?
I heard what was said about protective orders, that the burden of proof should be on the defendant to, you know, make the case that they need to have a copy of the recording. Am I understanding that correctly? First, okay. So how, what I'm trying to wrap my head around is, how would a defendant be able to make the case that they need the information, that they don't know what the information is? and justify that they need that information. How does that happen?
I think by accessing the police reports, knowing if there have been possibly inconsistent statements, having their attorney go through the reports, the detective reports, and seeing what information they can get. And if they have questions, then they can go before the court and ask that they be allowed to see a transcript of the grand jury testimony.
One clarification for either, I guess it would be either Rosemary or Aaron. Both of you made a comment as to the victim needing to have a separate attorney. If I remember correctly, then under the victim's rights, the district attorney has been tasked to be the representative of a victim. And so why wouldn't we have the ADA, I mean, assistant district attorney or the district attorney going forward for protective orders on behalf of the victim if that's what they wanted to do?
Senator Przanski, Vice Chair Cruz, a crime victim gets to choose who asserts his or her rights, and a prosecutor can choose not to assert rights of a crime victim. There are legitimate reasons that a prosecutor would not assert a crime victim's rights. If the prosecutor chooses not to seek a protective order or seeks a protective order on different grounds than the crime victim feels is appropriate, then the crime victim is left with seeking a protective order. Ms. Brewer and her crew spend most of the time, most of their time, representing crime victims in situations in which their rights are either not being recognized by the prosecution, or more generally, their rights to privacy, for example. Some prosecutors don't think they have standing to assert those rights for victims. So, no, the prosecutor does not have to assert the right for victims. The victim gets to decide whether that's the case, and then only if the prosecutor is willing to assert the rights on behalf of the victim.
All right. Thank you very much. We had one other person we were going to try to get testimony from, but I've also been asked by the president's office to conclude, so a couple of my colleagues can go into caucus. So I guess I'd like to see if you want to conclude at this point. With that, we're going to have to conclude based on the need to allow for two of the members to excuse themselves to be in another meeting that has already been preset. I know that John Harrelson was wanting to testify today. I'm sorry, John. I think at this point I'm going to have to ask you to come back based on I'm not going to continue the testimony when I have two of my members who want to hear the testimony firsthand not be able to participate. So with that, at this point, we're going to conclude our public hearing on 1550 for today. What we're going to be doing, though, is that we're going to be carrying over 1550, as well as, just for the record, 1556 and 1571 will all be on Tuesday of next week. That leaves what we already have set for Monday. Some of this has already been preset with people from coming in from out of state. We have Senate Bill 1553, 1555, 1576, and hopefully the paperwork will be ready for 1552, and we can move that forward. Anything else? Monday, I believe we start at 8:30. So 8:30 Monday morning. Colleagues, we're adjourned for the day. Monday morning. Colleagues, we're adjourned.